After having spent enough time in this sordid rock and roll game, in front of and behind the curtain, nothing really shocks me anymore. You find out very quickly, rock and roll cliches arise because they happen more times than you can count. Any ridiculous happenstance or occurrence that sounds too absurd for everyday life is only too common within rock and roll's periphery. Sometimes this world that I'm placed in, that I'm surrounded by, is so preposterous, so farcical, that when the genuine article, a real unaffected character, walks by, most people are stunned, in awe, and line up to touch the hem of their tight-fitting jeans. Most of the time, however, it's a scene filled with a lot of bravado and posturing. When I've met some of these personalities, it usually goes one of three ways. Either they turn out to be exactly what I thought they'd be, usually genial and approachable, or they are at least awkwardly cordial, and that's fine too. Guarded defensive responses most likely stem from past experiences with rude people. After having been in this music industry long enough myself, I get it. And I'm happy to report that there's never really been a time I've met someone vaunted who turned out to be a complete asshole. Those are reserved for people in newly touted bands who still don't know how to handle their newfound popularity. And then there's that third and rare occasion I meet someone who I have admired for a long time, and they turn out to not only impress me with their candidness and affability, but go against type and impress me further with their confidence and self-assurance. Martin Ain, bassist of the legendary Hellhammer and Celtic Frost, or Celtic Frost, depending on which side of the Atlantic you live on, is someone I've known for over 10 years. I met him in Zurich on my spoken word tour, and it was a great night, but what made it memorable was getting a chance to meet and hang out with Martin. I was completely shocked he not only knew our band, but knew our music too. Here was someone who formed the way I took in and registered music. Albums like Into the Pandemonium smashed barriers for me and challenged me at an age when most people are just trying to go with the flow. Morbid Tales is an album that can be credited to kickstarting a genre, and for some, a way of life. When does a band know they've created something so unique and yet so influential? When they are eulogized, but nobody even comes close to sounding like them, when most don't even dare to try. Now, the first time I laid eyes on Celtic Frost was watching their crude Circle of Tyrants video on television. They scared the shit out of me. They looked like the devil worshippers all our parents warned us about. You know, the kind that drink blood and make sacrificial offerings? Martin was at his metal thrashing best. And to understand the context of how much of an audible and visual impact Celtic Frost made, how much of an anomaly they were, you have to know. People were still buying copies of Michael Jackson's Thriller album when they recorded this song and made this video. That's how ahead of the pack they were. So being introduced to Celtic Frost under that context, and then meeting Martin years later while hosting his weekly Tuesday night Karaoke from Hell event was supremely, supremely surreal. I realized that night what people think they know of Martin Ain is only one side to an extremely interesting multi-sided coin. Since then, I have always managed to keep up with Martin. We see each other every other year or so, and it's always a good talk. You can chalk this episode to how our past conversations have gone. And I too have participated in the Karaoke from Hell Tuesday night event at his Mascot Club in Zurich. Most recently, I sang after our set in Interlaken, Switzerland at the Greenfield Festival with bandleader Boris Mueller. This year, I did Jumpin' Jack Flash and Rebel Yell, and it's fun to perform. But to be introduced by Martin Ain himself is what keeps me coming back. This episode was recorded an hour or so before our scheduled set time in the backstage festival compound, and you can no doubt hear the other acts performing in the background. If this episode ends abruptly to you, It's only because I had to start warming up for our own gig, but trust me, I can talk to Martin Ain all day long. And without a doubt, this will not be his last appearance on the podcast. He's just too interesting to not want to hear more from. I want to thank everyone who has left a review and or a rating for the podcast online. Thanks for taking the time to even listen to the episodes. And thanks for the support from Blue Mic Microphones and Skull Candy Headphones. This is an episode with a great man, a good friend, Mr. Martin Ain, on the official Danko Jones podcast, and it starts now. The Danko Jones podcast is the best around. Nick Flanagan is Danko's co-host. Cool. Hello for free. I'm so glad I like to sometimes. Jimmy in from fucked up. Stop playing. Hang down. The googly gaggly goblins will make sure they get their podcast fill by listening to Danko Jones, then snacking on some broken bones. And scaredy cats will run amok when rock and roll starts to talk, flapping gums and striking tongues. A chilly podcast has now begun. And I said the Danko Jones podcast makes me feel alright. The Danko Jones podcast makes me feel alright. Number one in the world, one in the world. It makes me feel alright. The Danko Jones podcast is the best. Hey, Martin, thanks for coming, meeting me here at the Greenfield Festival today.
Yeah, you're welcome, Danko. You know, I mean, like, since we got the time and the day and the date and everything all right, wouldn't miss the opportunity.
This just happened because Boris emailed me yesterday.
That's right. I thought about getting in touch with you, but then I was really busy the last couple of days, the kind of like uncomfortable busy, you know, and Boris, the way he is, just got in touch. So
we've played this festival. I think this is the fourth time we've played here. This is the first time you're here, at least in my experience.
Yeah. Festivals, attending-wise, are not really my cup of tea. I like to go to shows. I like to see bands. But usually, if it's open space, tens of thousands of people, it's not really. Unless, of course, playing them, you know. But otherwise, I love to see the bands on their own with their own show. But I have to say it was fun, you know. But of course, we were also working here, you know, on the festival. We were playing with Karaoke from Hell, doing three shows at the Rockstar Block.
Now, that's when I first met. We first met, unbeknownst to myself, I did a spoken word show in 2004 at the Mascot Club in Zurich. And then everybody told me afterwards, they said afterwards, Martin Ain from Celtic Frost is hosting this karaoke night. And I said, what? And then that night you came, we met, and then I sang, and it ended up being the highlight of my little spoken word tour for me.
That was a fun night, you know. I think it was a great mix-up because, not a mix-up, you know, but in a say it was a great mashup of things because you did what normally rock and rollers don't do, you know, go on the stage and speak. You know, besides the few, the odd Henry Rollins, it's not that many out of the rock circuit that do that, you know. And then, of course, we do this karaoke, this entertainment show, you have to say, where the audience comes on the stage and then sings with the band, you know. So it's two rock and roll things that really are not considered to be what rock and roll generally is, you know. And I think the more fun it was.
Well, for me, that after that night, I saw you in a different light too, because think of it from my end, the only thing I know of you at the time that I knew of you was you had the black collar, you had the Celtic Frost, you scared me. And then that night I watched with my jaw to the floor going, I can't believe this guy's like a comedian. And so that in that way, like, that kind of blew me away that night to see you in this new light, in a very lighthearted way. A lot of people outside of Zurich or outside of Switzerland don't realize that about you, I think. They just see the, you know, the black the metal, the, you know, all that.
Yeah, they see the Celtic Frost persona, or even the Hellhammer persona, the Slate Necros, you know. But of course, I am just a human being like every other human being. And I, of course, I think I can be a fun guy and I can be very entertaining. And I think that's why I started hosting the show. I mean, that form was my idea to do that when we started that club, the Mascot. We said we want to do a rock and roll night, you know. And
that's your club. That's
your right. Yeah, I'm co-management, co-owner, you know. I'm with friends of mine together, we're running that club. And we wanted to do a rock night, you know. And on the weekends, rock in Zurich is not really working that well because Zurich has never been a real rock, or you have to say a hard rock city. Used to be punk rock, but then straight, you know, punk rock, you know, politically correct, and you had to have a message and a meaning and a seal to it. But rock and roll, just like as a lifestyle, is not really that big in Zurich. It's more like electronic music and hip hop, you know. That's big. So we knew we would have to do that night during week time. And we said, like, okay, what can you do? But, you know, just like have a DJ play rock music like on a Tuesday night, it's never going to work in Zurich. You will not have a turnout. And just get the local bands playing after, like, every Tuesday night after half a year, you will have run through every band that really is of any interest, you know. So we said, we need to do something that we can do every night, and it'll work every night, and it'll be, you know, the same but still different. That's how we came up with this karaoke idea. And we've been doing that night, that, you know, every Tuesday night at the Mascot for like 10 years, except for like 3 months summer break. So in 10 years, we played around 500 shows just at the Mascot alone, Tuesday nights. You know,
you guys did a book too. I'm in the book.
Yeah, we did a photo book. That was more like a community book, what you would call, mean for listeners in North America, most probably a high school yearbook, you know, something like this. So we did a karaoke from hell yearbook. We had a photographer with us for like every show or every other show for like almost 2 years, a year and a half, taking pictures of the singers on stage and immediately after the performance off stage, you know, taking a portrait shot. And then, of course, taking pictures from the show and everything because we wanted something to remember by. Because after, like, doing the show for 5 years, we had realized people come, people go, the times are changing. You know, there have been people that met up at Karaoke from Hell, couples that have met up, get married, had a kid. Second name of the kid was Lemmy because father and mother met up at the Mascot when the father was singing Motorhead Ace of Spades, you know. And so they gave the kid the second name Lemmy. And by now, 10 years later, that kid is
grade
five, 8 years, yeah. 8 years old or something like, yeah, this, 8 or 9 years old. And the parents are divorced already. So times go by, and we wanted something to, you know, like I said, like a high school yearbook, something you can hold in your hands and take out and look. But so, you know, basically a community book. It wasn't for the wider distribution because that's the Karaoke from Hell thing, of course, was is more like a local thing. Although we perform all over Switzerland. I mean, we played a Montreux Jazz Festival 2 years ago.
Really? What did you do?
We played at
jazz?
Karaoke from Hell, you know.
Yeah, with jazz fans.
In Montreux Jazz Festival, come on, it's not a jazz festival.
No,
anymore.
I know. It's
just a jazz festival by name, you know.
Oh yeah, that's right. Of course.
I mean, you have everybody performing there. You had Slayer performing at Montreux, you know, if I'm not mistaken. Yeah, I think Slayer performed at Montreux, if I'm not mistaken. You know, you had a Nightwish performed there, I think a year ago or something like this, if I'm not mistaken. You know, so you got metal there as well. You know, you got rock, pop, metal. You have everything at the Montreux Jazz Festival, and it worked really, really well. Although I have to say, I was really, really, really pissed off at the end of the show, because at the end of the show we had packed house. We had like a 2.5 hour show, people coming onto the stage singing every song imaginable, rock, punk, hardcore, heavy metal, whatever we got on the list. You know, we got like 150 songs on that Karaoke from Hell song list. And the one song that I was really certain of, the one song that I thought this is the one that everybody wants to perform at the Montreux Jazz Festival, nobody requested. Smoke on the Water by Deep Purple, because that song, yeah, that song was written in Montreux. That song is about Montreux and the Montreux Jazz Festival. You know, when Frank Zappa played there and the casino where the festival took place, Frank Zappa played there at the jazz festival, and the casino started burning up, you know. And so it's all about it. And nobody requested it. So I had to force somebody from the audience. And
I would have done it. I would have done it.
Force, you know, force funny, you know. Right. I had to force him up onto the stage, hijack him, you know, Shanghai him, you know, really just like, hey, you know, we can't walk off the stage with this kind of show. And it's all about history in a part, you know. That's what I like about that karaoke format. You bring rock history to the people and they can partake in it. It's not like they're standing in front of a stage, you know, just adoring their idols. They can be, you know, have the feel of what it is like to be their idols for like 5 minutes, you know, the famous Andy Warhol saying, you know, everybody's gonna be a star for 15 minutes. Karaoke from Hell is doing their part to make that come true. And also, on the other hand, I thought, like with that song, you know, Deep Purple, Smoke on the Water. I think it was a year earlier that Claude Knops, you know, the founder of the Montreux Jazz Festival and basically the godfather of it, you know, had died. So I thought, this is how you keep the spirit alive, you know. When we started out, the Ramones were still performing as a band. And now, not one of the original Ramones is still alive. And I like to point that out when people come onto the stage and sing the Ramones and say, like, hey, listen, from here on now, this is how that music will stay alive. Because we, our generation, part of our generation, will start experiencing and realizing all the original creators and performers of this music passing on. But the music's still lasting, and it will only last if people will still listen to it and live it, you know. And I think this is Karaoke from Hell in a fun way.
Well, a lot of people, what they don't realize when they hear, oh, you're doing Karaoke from Hell, you present each, anyone who signs up to, you know, karaoke is this whole thing, this concept is worldwide.
Yeah.
But the difference with your karaoke is when they sign up, you introduce the person who it is, right? That's what you usually do.
You got the band, you know, the idea is generally karaoke is you got a screen in front of you and music blasting out of the speakers, and on the screen you got the lyrics with a, most probably a silly video of a girl walking through some park that you don't really know where it's all, where it is really at. And then the lyrics are being cursor pointed out, you know, so you know when to sing them. Karaoke from Hell, you got the lyrics in front of you projected on the screen, but no cursor pointing out because the music's being played live. And so the tempo always is prone to variation, you know.
You have to know the song.
That's right. And you got a band on stage, regular, you know, live setup, and the people walk onto the stage. I usually say they walk up the stairway to Karaoke from Hell Heaven, you know.
Right.
For like 5 minutes of fame, or maybe sometimes 6 minutes if it's a longer song, you know, or 2.5 seconds if they choose Napalm Death, You Suffer, you know, because we got that on the list as well. And I introduce the people. And I introduce the people, the singers, and what song they are going to do, you know. And usually I have to say, we get great singers. We get people that have their own bands, you know, and are even performing artists like yourself that come to sing. But we got everyday regular Joes that come onto stage and ridicule themselves, you know, because they don't really know how to do it, or they have overestimated themselves, or maybe the beer, you know, the amount of beer that they had that night has made them overestimate themselves. So they can make an ass of themselves. And I have to say, this is the fun thing about karaoke as well, that the people really appreciate it, you know. Sometimes people that fuck up, but they fuck up royally, you know, and give everything into it, you know, get the most applause and the most appreciation because people can relate to them, you know. Fun stuff.
But what a lot of people don't realize, and what I didn't realize until I saw it firsthand, is you are like a comedian and on stage up at Karaoke from Hell. So we started off this talk talking about how I went there and I was doing something out of my element, which was spoken word. Have you ever considered doing something very similar in the spoken word realm?
Actually, I had given it some thought. I was sitting together for a time with a friend of mine who was doing the what you would call a cabaret comedy circle in German-speaking Switzerland. and he's got his own program, and we were talking about doing something together, but that didn't come into passing to fruition. Yeah, that's true. And so I thought maybe doing something on my own, but I was really busy with everything else that I had started doing in the 90s. Like I said, like the club, or it's also a bar that I'm running, you know. And I did the karaoke show every week, you know. And on the weekends we did shows in other clubs throughout German speaking Switzerland, you know. So I've been busy with that, and it's been lasting for like 10 years at the same place, you know. So for a long time. But I now have been thinking more about that. I should maybe try to do something like that again.
Because, I mean, obviously from the Celtic Frost years, Hellhammer years, people, that those years have become legend and almost myth to the new crops of fans who love that kind of music. And you have all those stories. I'm sure you've got tons of them. And I think you can deliver them in a way that's humorous, lighthearted, and even for people who aren't necessarily into the genre of music, they could get entertained by how you deliver the stories.
Could be a good idea, you know. But then again, you know, I don't know if it really, just like going out and telling stories about the old days, would be the thing for me to do anymore, because I think the old days have been worked up to a certain extent. You know, there have been the books that Tom of course wrote, or that we co-worked on, you know, the Are You Morbid first autobiography, and then Only Death Is Real, you know, where you have a wider scope, because you have basically a lot of the key players, most of the key players involved of the forming of Hellhammer and Celtic Frost are in this book, you know. And fun stuff, fun stories from the past could be one thing, but I think it should be more than just that, you know, basically. I think this would be a focus just on the past. Maybe that would be a starting point. It's a good idea, maybe as a starting point. But I think it should be more open, you know.
You can talk about a variety of subjects.
I can talk about anything and everything, you know. And I can talk for hours without even saying something that in the end makes any sense. But everybody still thinks they got the point, you know. I think this is a God-given talent, you know. I think actually was passed through by my mother to me. My mother was able to do that. You know, she was able to talk, and people were all agreeing. And in the end, I was thinking, what was she really saying, you know? Maybe I should have become a politician, because in the end, I think that's what politicians do for a living, you know.
Yeah, you have to get a haircut though, or no?
Nowadays, I'm not really that certain anymore. Yeah, most probably should, but there are like in the more conservative right wing fraction in Switzerland, the biggest party, you know, which is there's a long hair politician that has risen through the ranks. Could be possible. Although I imagine, you know, the first time I'll try to run for mayor in Zurich, you know, I'll be doing some serious you know, podium discussions, and they'll be projecting Hellhammer, Slate, Necros, Corpse Paint pictures while I'm doing that. I don't think that really would work, you know. Do you really want that guy to be your mayor? You know, Triumph of Death, yeah, maybe not. You know, Satanic Rites.
I would spin it like you've gotten that out of your system now. And now you're ready to be serious, and you're ready to be with the people. Yeah, where no skeletons left in the closet.
Maybe I need you as my campaign.
Yeah.
I think you would be a great campaign manager. And then afterwards, if we have succeeded, you can become the official spokesperson, you know, like...
Martin is not taking any questions today. Thank you. Good day. There's one thing that was just told to me about you. And when they found out that I was going to do this podcast with you, they said, ask him about your model collection. Are you a crazy model collector?
Not models, toys.
toy collector. Someone said you take 2 weeks off and you just, whatever it is, work on your collection.
You know, it doesn't take any work because it's not a model collection where I put together models and paint them up. No, it's not action figures. I used to collect action figures in the 80s, you know, because there wasn't that much else around that I could get a hold of back in here in Switzerland or in Europe, you know, back in the day. And before the age of the internet was much, much more difficult. And I got into kaiju a long time ago, you know, but those were really hard to get a hold of. Kaiju, that's Japanese monsters. Basically, the godfather of kaiju is Godzilla, you know. And Eiichi Tsuburaya, you know, he's special effects artist for a lot of those Toho big monster movies, you know, like Godzilla. He created those famous TV series like Ultra Q and Ultraman, you know, where in every episode, you know, Ultraman would battle another foe, another like giant monster that would threaten Japan, you know. And those giant monsters, they are kaiju, you know. And of course, since the 60s, or you might have to say since the 50s, but basically since the 60s, those programs got really, really popular with kids, so there were toys created. Those programs had, you know, did become less of horror and more of like kids action sci-fi adventure movies, you know, like the character Gamera from a foe in the beginning. He had turned into a positive figure at the end of the series and was always interacting with the kids, you know, to set rights, to set wrongs right, you know.
Did you follow that all the way through that period?
No. In the 60s, I saw most of the kaiju movies. I think I saw every kaiju movie that got released here in Europe and Switzerland in the German speaking part, because they were playing in the movies sometimes a lot of times as double features, you know, a lot of times as double features. I got to see a lot of those. I got to see them on television. Not all of them I did get to see on in the cinema because I was too young to go to the cinema back, you know, in the early 70s, but I saw them on television, and I was really a sucker for them. I had my first Godzilla toy when I was, 7 years old, seven years old. I still have it, yeah, of course. I've been collecting since I was a kid. So I collect kaiju, I collect toys. In general, you might have to say I collect comic books, you know. I have collected records, but I'm an eclectic record collector, you know. I'm not collecting any certain style of music or specific style of music or certain artists. Certain artists I collect, try to get everything I can get a hold of, but sometimes if I don't like a record, I don't buy it.
So what do you mean by eclectic?
Eclectic, whatever I like, you know, whatever I think is good, ends up in the collection.
Like, but it's popular music?
Oh, it's everything. It's from experimental. It could be from How to Train Your Dogs they're in the 60s and 70s, you know, with the counterculture rising. There have been records on occultism, you know, on the occult, you know, and how to properly form your witch coven and what do satanic rituals sound like. I mean, Anton LaVey, you know, he made a couple of records with and from the First Church of Satan, and he of course made this really famous record with his it's more than keyboard, it's organ, the church organ playing, you know, that has been re-released, of course, you know, I think in two different versions. One of his really beautiful 10-inch, you know.
I got
that one too. So, you know, I've been collecting this. I've been collecting everything, if it's got that certain satanic touch to it, but it doesn't have to be really satanic or evil, but it just uses the imagery for something that normally you wouldn't consider the devil's music, you know, like 70s disco, you know, then...
I see. As long as it uses the symbolism or the...
That's right. Images and trying to build up on something, you know, or with electronic music that when you listen to the music, doesn't really sound evil, you know, that anything, basically. I'm easy listening, you know, even if it's sometimes more easy listening, you know, but it pertains to the easy listening genre, whatever. Soundtracks, you know, soundtracks have become really, really popular again. There are a lot of small labels out there that re-release and even release for the first time properly release great scores, you know, from movies from the 60s, 70s, and 80s. You know, there's a, in England, there's a great label, Def Waltz Records. I don't know if you know, those guys do a really great job, you know, for example. Yeah, anyhow. So I got, I'm collecting in a wide way, and especially with the records, it's really, as I said, eclectic.
Well, I started on Instagram. I started posting some of my more offbeat records that I have, and I always left a hashtag next level record collecting. So, which I meant, I use that meaning, you know, beyond your Abbey Road and beyond your Zeppelin Houses of the Holy. Once, how many times do we need to buy that? Once you're past that, for me, I start looking for really fucked up weird records, and it's not necessary. I don't adhere to like the occult symbolisms like you do, but it's more like just the weirdest fucking shit I could find, like How to Train Your Parakeet, or like how to skate properly, you know, like that kind of stuff. Those or like a movie star who you never thought would sing, but their ego just got so big they thought they could do anything, and they put out a record. That's the kind of stuff I love.
Yeah, there's fun stuff out there, you know. There is, always has been, and most probably there always will be, and you don't have to go for the Hoff, you know, who did music, and he became really successful with it,
Yeah.
I mean, successful to the degree that he thinks he's partly responsible for the Berlin Wall coming down, you know, basically. Yeah, not really like that, but just he had this massive hit, I'm Looking for Freedom, and it was number one in Germany, and it was number one at the time, you know, when the Berlin Wall came down, right. So this is what everybody was singing and listening to, because in the title, basically, it's what the way I'm putting it out right now is I'm simplifying to the max here, you know. Of course, it didn't really come to pass as I say it, but nowadays when you listen to the Hoff talk about it, it sounds like it just came to pass like that, right. You know, so everybody was going for that, but it really is in a degree it's true, you know, that this was one of the anthems, you know, of change, of course, just like Winds of Change by the Scorps, that's true. And so, but he's an example for classic example for a singing actor. But of course, Leonard Nimoy also is quite known, Twinkle Twinkle Little Star, you know. Right, yeah. But one of my favorites, my all-time favorite singing wise, I have to say, is Robert Mitchum. Robert Mitchum did great, an amazing, a fantastic Calypso record. Calypso is Like So.
Calypso what?
I think the title is Calypso is Like So.
Whoa.
And it's really amazing. And his voice, it works. Title? Yeah, I've got the original, and I got a reprint as well. I got the original first edition, and it cost a little bit. It was a little costly. Already in the, I got it in the early 90s. I think I bought it in France in 92 or something like this, or 91. And it was already pricey back then. I think maybe the prices have gone up. But you get reprints, and you get it on CD, and it's good music. I mean, most probably you can download it or file share it or whatever. And I think it's worthwhile, because really, really is a great record. And I have to say, I'm a sucker for early Caribbean music, especially Calypso, because my mom, she, one of her favorites, she was always into the Rat Pack. She was into, you know, Frank Sinatra and Sammy Davis Jr. Her favorite was Dean Martin, of course. Her favorite was Dean Martin all the way. I think one of the reasons why I'm named Martin as well, I think. Yeah, I mean, she said something like this, you know. Anyhow, and but her favorite, she was Harry Belafonte, you know, and she was listening to Harry Belafonte all the time. And of course, Harry Belafonte comes from this culture, you know, from this Caribbean, West Indian Caribbean music culture, you know. And so she listened to basically Calypso, you know. And when I discovered that Robert Mitchum had done a record, you know, I heard it at a friend of mine in Berlin had it. And when I was there in the 80s, he played it for me. I was like, hey, wow, mind-altering, a revelation. It's a really good record, you know. Matilda, she take your money and run Venezuela. Everybody go. No, it's really, you didn't know that?
I didn't know that about you.
You didn't know that about Robert Mitchum?
I didn't know that.
Because Robert Mitchum basically, to most people in our line of work, you know, and in our style of music, Robert Mitchum is, of course, the good and the evil hand, you know, the preacher from The Night of the Hunter, which is an excellent movie. And I got, by the way, I got the spoken word record of Night of the Hunter spoken by Charles Laughton, you know, the director of the movie. And Charles Laughton is really one of the great voices and the great actors of his era, you know, and the record is amazing. I mean, you should listen to that.
Dude, you're blowing me away with all these amazing... I didn't know that you were that much of a collector, where you got into it that much.
It's not only a collector. I would just say I'm into popular culture, you know, and comic books, movies, or you have to say comic art, basically, you know, because it's also an art form. When you say comic books, everybody's thinking of Spider-Man and Superman. It's much, much more than that. You know, I mean, I couldn't afford the original Spider-Man or Superman, but I can afford some of the 80s mini comic books that I started buying in the 80s already, you know, by artists like Jeff Gator and Axano or Pusshead, of course, you know.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, I mean, he's part of that generation as well, you know. Most of those come from the 80s counterculture punk and post-punk era, you know, a lot of those comic artists. So
are you down with, like, McFarlane? Were you McFarlane?
Yeah, of course. I got McFarlane, as I said, in the 80s, collecting McFarlane action figures and all of that, and I was waiting for the first Spawn to be released, you know, and of course got the McFarlane, was reading McFarlane Spider-Man back in the day, you know, when it came out, all that. And of course Image was, had the air of something new happening, you know, in this crusted superhero, kind of like culture dominated by those two big wig companies, you know, Marvel and DC, that, you know, whose universes, it like gods, they were sitting, you know, on their universes into history and controlling it and telling everybody what they had to do and in what direction their characters had to go. So with Image, they had the air, the breath of change, of something new, you know, of something might happen that will take the entire idea of the superhero into a different direction. Which, of course, you have to say that those companies starting to realize that there's an audience out there that grew up with all this stuff and now is in the age where they want a different kind of storytelling in that regard. Or those companies started going in the right direction. You know, they started realizing, okay, there's creators out there that maybe we should give more free hand and maybe even give a little percentage of what the money or income, you know, they create for the companies. And so they gave a lot of freedom to Alan Moore, for that example, you know, to do something, you know, with their characters, with the Watchmen, you know, who which is, of course, for superheroes, basically, it's like the Catcher in the Rye, you know, mm-hmm. for American literature, you know.
Yeah.
Just...
And Swamp Thing, too. Right?
He started out with Swamp Thing. Yeah, he started... Of course, he had to work... He had to do his chores, you know, before he got the freedom to...
What was he doing before he started doing his
chores? He's a Brit. He's from England, you know. So he was working for 2000 AD, and he was doing some independent comics as well, you know. And he had created characters for 2000 AD, you know, like Doctor and Quinch, for example. Most probably characters you don't know. 2000 AD is most famous for Judge Dredd, you know. Judge Dredd is the character Judge Dredd is the character everybody knows from 2000 AD, and he had worked for 2000 AD and created some amazing comics for that. He did the British superhero that became, if I'm not mistaken, was it a Marvel or a DC superhero? Captain Britain, you know?
I know that superhero from just the Marvel universe.
It's Marvel. It's Marvel, correctly. Yeah, I think it's Marvel. Captain Britain, and so it was him, you know, doing Captain Britain in the UK as well, you know. A lot of great artists, you know, in the comic book field started or came from Britain, like in the you have to say in the Anglo-American, you know, comic book field. Of course, there's different comic book cultures out there. There's the French, you know, or BD comic book culture, and then there's the Japanese manga comic book culture. So there's completely different cultures, you know, out there with different artists that are all on their own absolutely amazing, you know. There's so much great stuff out there. There's so many great things, and there's so many connections between great things. You know, I started more and more realizing how important movies were for the rise of extreme music. Movies and movie soundtracks, or to be specific, movie, the sounds of the movies. I mean, where was extreme singing before The Exorcist and Evil Dead? Listen to those demonized humans, you know? The Python, the Python, the Python. You got your black metal voice in there. Or when you listen to Regan, you know, the girl being possessed in The Exorcist, when she speaks with the demonic voices. There you got your inspiration for extreme black and death metal singing in there already, you know? And you start realizing, okay, somebody has done that, it should be working, this is scary. So if we want to create scary music, you know, this is the way to go. Even if it was unintentionally, you know? But before those movies, there really wasn't any extreme singing. So I think, you know, movies, just generally speaking, a lot of things are more interconnected than you would normally think. Because usually when you tell the history of like some music genre, you just talk about the music and the people performing the music, but not about what has inspired them, not about what it was that besides the music got them into what they were doing,
and
you know?
Compounds and that, all it the does. Influences get lost.
It does.
But Mark, I gotta get
ready. No problem. You got your show.
I'm on.
You're talking for over an hour now, or what?
I just looked at the clock and I'm like, I got half an hour to warm up. But this is perfect. I mean, I knew you would hit it out there.
I would be warmed up right now.
I think the guys are freaking out. I'm not there.
Okay. Let's close it down.
No, this was awesome. Let's end it here. I knew it was going to be.
Let's end it here. Yeah, we should do that more often, basically.
Well,
you know.
Well, then how about we do it on Skype when I'm back home too?
Yeah, that's a good idea. I'm on Skype.
Okay. Thanks, Martin.
You're
awesome.
Welcome.
Ben. This is awesome. Thank you.
Yeah.